Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with tomorrow's release of the Mueller report, the impact of which has been cushioned by Barr, who by some accounts has managed to redact 60% of what Mueller found in his 22-month investigation. Craig Unger, the author of the new book House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia, joins us to discuss his article at the Washington Post, Trump's Businesses Are Full of Dirty Russian Money, The Scandal Is That It's Legal, and how frustrating it is that there is so much on the public record indicating Trump is a career criminal and a traitor, but so little is likely to emerge from Barr's clutches. Collusion or not, the record is clear that President Trump and the Russians are thick as thieves. For more than three decades, at least 13 people with known or alleged ties to the Russian mafia held deeds to, lived in, or ran criminal operations out of Trump Tower and other Trump properties. And Trump real estate was used to launder vast amounts of money from the Russian mob under the supervision of Russian intelligence, which regulates a criminal oligarchy in what is a security state headed by a former KGB colonel operating in league with organized crime. With Putin convinced America is a corrupt state that is easily corrupted, we will soon find out whether a man reeking of corruption who Russia helped get into office will get away with crimes staring us in the face. Then we'll speak with one of the world's 10 most influential intellectuals named by MIT, Douglas Rushkoff, who joins us in the studio to discuss his latest book, Team Human, and his article at Medium, Time for Progressives to Stop Shaming One Another. He's a research fellow at the Institute for the Future and the founder of the Laboratory for Digital Humanism at City University of New York. And we will look into the unfortunate revival of the 2016 campaign wars between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, inflamed by Neera Tanden, the head of the Center for American Progress, who worked on the Clinton campaign. And with digital technology being used to de-socialize us and alienate us from our humanity, we'll examine a glaring example of technology taking over from humans with disastrous consequences. We'll assess how the crashes of the Boeing 737 MAX 8 aircraft are not just exposing an over-reliance on computers, but are resulting in the destruction of brand America, as one of the U.S.'s most successful companies is now mired in scandal, ironically because of its successful regulatory capture of a government agency that in Trump's hands-off administration was supposed to oversee the safety of its product. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Craig Unger, the author of the New York Times bestseller House of Bush, House of Saud, the former deputy editor of the New York Observer and editor-in-chief of Boston Magazine. He has written about the Trump-Russia scandal for the New Republic and Vanity Fair, and his new book is House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. And he also has an article at the Washington Post, Trump's Businesses Are Full of Dirty Russian Money, The Scandal Is That It's Legal. Welcome to Background Briefing, Craig Unger.
Thanks for having me.
So, Craig, it must be very frustrating for you because I've often referred to your book, House of Trump, House of Putin, and other books that have been written about Trump's business practices and his relationships with the Russians who have financed him for decades. And much of it has been from Russian mob figures buying condos and laundering money through Trump properties. It's all there on the record, and yet there's a possibility that the Mueller report released tomorrow will not have any mention whatsoever of who this man is in terms of his business background and how deep his ties are to the Russians. And as you say in your New York Times article, collusion or not, President Trump and the Russians are thick as thieves. So this must frustrate you.
It's insanely frustrating. And I almost have to hand it to them. Attorney General Barr and the Republicans are dazzlingly brilliant at controlling the narrative. And I think most Americans are finding it very, very hard to follow and piece together what has happened. And they have busy lives, and they're hit with fragments and atomized parts of this conversation again and again. But it doesn't really add up to one sustaining narrative, which I try to show in my book. But there, you know, there are over 300 million people who aren't really following at that kind of level. And what Barr has done, I mean, and you have to look at the timing, because they're going to release this new Mueller report, and you can bet it will be heavily expurgated. It will be redacted again and again. The Democrats are going to have to fight for a lot of stuff to get out there. But they're doing it just as Congress is going on a brief recess of about 10 days, which means the Democrats won't be able to really press their advantage, and that the Republicans will control the narrative. I mean, I had thought once the Democrats won Congress back in November that they'd come in fighting in January, and we'd have day after day of hearings, not just the Mueller report, but we'll have the House Intelligence Committee, the House Judiciary Committee, the House Oversight Committee having nationally televised hearings, as we did back in Watergate 40 years ago, so that people would finally be able to see what really happened. And except for one day with Michael Cohen testifying, which was sort of electrifying, by the way, that story has not really gotten out there. And yet it is part of the public record. If you look in the public record in court documents, if people are willing to spend hours and hours on the internet piecing together.
Well, of course, the report is coming out on the eve of Good Friday and Passover, and a lot of people are taking an Easter break along with the Congress itself. So you have to hand it to the Republicans. It's perfect timing if you really want to bury the Mueller report.
Right, and the Republicans have been terrific at that. You have to give them credit. When the Democrats won the House back in November, I thought they'd come out fighting in January and we'd see day after day of nationally televised hearings. We need a shared national narrative, a shared national spectacle, instead of all this atomized, incremental, fragmentary reporting that's bombarding people. But except for one day in which Michael Cohen televised, testified on national TV, that really hasn't happened. And that's because of the way the Republicans have orchestrated things. They delay, delay, delay. They stall. They refuse to honor subpoenas. They force the Democrats to then go to the courts and fight slowly through the courts, which takes time again. And they're delaying it right up to the 2020 elections, at which point conventional wisdom has it that impeachment may well backfire if the Democrats go that route. So they've been very successful at suppressing the real story.
And why do you think that is? Why are they in league with a criminal and a traitor?
Well, with Trump, they really own the Russians really own Donald Trump. He owes his whole fortune to him. And I go into that in the book, and I show how going back 35 years ago in 1984, he first began allowing his real estate to launder money for the Russian mafia. And he ended up there were at least 1,300 of his condos that appear to have been used for money laundering. By that, I mean they were used for sold in all cash purchases to anonymous shell companies. Those are the criteria that set off alarm bells for people investigating money laundering. And an awful lot of that money was Russian. And he still went broke in Atlantic City by overexpanding and accumulating $4 billion in debt. And when that happened, the Russians rescued him once again. And they had a real estate firm called the Bayrock Group that was in Trump Tower, and they made him an offer he could not refuse. They said they put up hundreds of millions, even a couple of billion dollars for various projects that they partnered with. And they said to Trump, you don't have to put up a dime. We just want to franchise your name. You don't even have to develop the project. We'll do that. And in return, we'll give you 18 to 25% of the money. And that's how he got back on his feet financially.
And again, I'm speaking with Craig Unger, the author of the New York Times bestseller, House of Bush, House of Saud, the former deputy editor of the New York Observer and editor-in-chief of Boston Magazine. He has written about the Trump-Russia scandal for the New Republic and Vanity Fair. And his new book is House of Trump, House of Putin, the untold story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. And he also has an article at the Washington Post, Trump's businesses are full of dirty Russian money. The scandal is that it's legal. So, Craig, in terms of the research you've done in your heavily researched book, House of Trump, House of Putin, a lot of the research, I understand, came from FBI files. So the FBI have been literally on to Trump forever. I don't understand how it is that, you know, I can't imagine that Mueller hasn't seen this stuff. I mean, there's got to be piles and piles of FBI material dating back to the mid-1980s on Trump and the Russians. These are Russian gangsters living in Trump Tower. They had a weekly poker game at which Trump showed up and they let him win, and they had all these scantily clad Russian girls waiting on him hand and foot. And much later, the FBI actually busted the gambling ring of Russian gangsters in Trump Tower. So what happened to all of those FBI reports? Did Mueller see them, or are they just not a part of his purview when it comes to this investigation he's done, and which I guess is rather narrowly defined?
Well, there are two possible explanations and also a lot of unanswered questions. But one thing is that Mueller is a prosecutor. His job is to indict and prosecute and get convictions. And there are incredibly lax regulations regarding money laundering and real estate. And that is, it's very, very, and what it means is it's very, very hard to prove that the seller has knowledge that he is receiving money from illicit sources. So he may, proving that Donald Trump was knowledgeable that he was getting money from Russian criminals can be very, very difficult. And Mueller's job, again, is to prosecute. So that's one part of it. The other part is, I wonder if the FBI itself may be compromised in some regard. And by that, I mean Felix Sater is a very important figure in this. And he was managing director of the Bayrock Real Estate Group, which was in Trump Tower and partnered with Donald Trump. And Felix Sater was born in Russia. His father was allegedly in the Russian mafia. And he allegedly has had ties as well. And when he started working pretty closely with Trump around 2002. And Felix had flipped and was an FBI informant. After one of his convictions, he made a deal with the FBI. And in this regard, he sort of resembles Whitey Bulger, who was a mobster in Boston, who was part of the Irish mafia, who became an FBI informant, an FBI cooperator. And while he was still cooperating with the FBI, Whitey Bulger committed quite a few murders and literally got away with murder. If you're familiar with the movie The Departed by Martin Scorsese with Jack Nicholson, that was sort of a Romana Clay about the Whitey Bulger story. And I've always asked the question of whether Felix Sater is sort of Whitey Bulger on steroids. That is, here he was working with the FBI. He was an FBI informant while he was also working with Donald Trump on projects that appear to have been laundering money for the Russian mafia. Did they let him get away with that because he was an FBI cooperator? That's a question I would love to have answered.
Well, it's extraordinary. And of course, the FBI, one of the FBI guys looking into him, Bob Levinson. And Levinson, of course, died mysteriously or disappeared mysteriously on an Iranian island. I understand he was frustrated, as were other members of the FBI team, in terms of trying to get a wire into Trump Tower, etc. So was Trump's celebrity a problem in the FBI's inquiry into obvious criminal activity that was going on right in front of their noses?
Yeah, I don't know exactly how they related to Trump, but I mean, it's also worth remembering that Rudy Giuliani was very close to the FBI, and Trump had a lot of supporters within the FBI. And I've always thought that there was sort of almost a Rudy Giuliani wing of the FBI. And it was also interesting that I think some of, when you look at Felix Sater again and who his FBI handlers were, where are they now? Where did they end up working? And two of them ended up working for the Trump Organization, which is quite a coincidence, I think.
So the Mueller report, again, his writ was fairly narrow. And of course, the word collusion, which Trump has seized on, is a convenient way to dodge the fact that his relationships with the Russians go back certainly to 1985 with the gangsters buying into Trump Tower. And then in 87, his first trip to Moscow. And it seems like from the very beginning, the Russians have been dangling a Trump Tower in Moscow as a kind of lure to bait this guy who was so manifestly corruptible.
Absolutely. To me, the use of the word collusion sort of misdirected people. And the real concern I address in my book is that Trump was compromised. And I believe he was compromised more than 30 years ago. Again, if you go back to 1984, you have the beginning. At first, he is selling condos to the Russian mafia. And the Russian mafia, it's really important to understand that they're very different from the Italian-American mafia we're more familiar with. And the big difference is that they are state actors. The Italians are always at war with the FBI. The Russian mafia is in league with the Kremlin and Russian intelligence. So when they are laundering money through Donald Trump, Russian intelligence knows that. And not long after he started that, they approached him, and Ambassador Dubinin and his daughter went up to Trump Tower. They met with Trump and invited him to lunch. And then they proceeded to invite him to Moscow and said, "We want a Trump Tower in Moscow, just like you have in New York." And during that first visit, it appears that Trump may well have been compromised. I interviewed General Oleg Kalugin, who was head of counterintelligence for the KGB. And he told me he believed that Trump was compromised. There was actually compromise of a sexual nature during that first visit in 1987. And whether that's true or not, when Trump returned, people forget this. He ran for president in 1988, and he took out a full-page ad in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Boston Globe announcing a foreign policy that could have been written by Vladimir Putin. I mean, it called for the end of NATO. It was an attack on the Western alliance. It was so out of sync with American foreign policy that it was breathtaking. And this is more than 30 years ago.
Well, there have been rumors of compromise from that 1987 trip of Trump's, where his wife Ivana acted as his translator since she spoke Russian. And there's some reports that she herself may have been compromised or may have been working for the STB, the Czech Intelligence Services, which were in league with the KGB. They had a program where they sent attractive women from the Eastern Bloc into the West in order to lure wealthy and influential people into marriage and other personal compromises. There are a lot of KGB people who say that Trump was compromised in Leningrad with some young women in 87. But in your discussions with Kalugin, were you able to pin him down or pin anybody down on what it is they have in compromise? Not the PP tape that everybody talks about from 2013 in the Ritz Hotel in Moscow. This goes back to 87.
Right. Well, I did not get all the answers to that question. And Kalugin had not personally seen any compromise. He did, however, have institutional knowledge. As I say, he was head of counterintelligence for the KGB, and that's a pretty high position.
So just in the last minute then, Craig Ung, I take it you're not expecting much from tomorrow's release of the Mueller report, albeit that supposedly 60% of it has been redacted by Barr. And how much of it do you think is going to survive? Because as we've been discussing, there's so much out there in your book and on the record about what a crook and a traitor this guy is. And it's just extraordinary at this point. If the Republicans and Barr can cover this thing up, that is just beyond belief.
Right. Well, I think we'll have more questions than the answers, and then eventually it will surface. But the Republicans are going to play the stalling game as long as they can every time they get a chance to do that. And it's sort of shocking in a way because so much is on the public record. I don't like the word collusion, but so much of this took place in plain sight that it's just breathtaking. And that should not exculpate Trump, that he would say at public rallies that were televised, Russia, if you've got those 30,000 emails, release them. And then they released them. Or we saw that Roger Stone talking about his contacts with Julian Assange. So we've seen this kind of thing again and again. We saw Trump tweeted, I believe it was 1,100 times, criticizing Mueller and the investigation as a hoax, as a witch hunt. If that's not obstruction of justice. We saw him fire James Comey in plain view. So much has happened in plain view that it's just breathtaking. And Trump famously said he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. Well, it's like he's conducted his whole defense that way.
Well, Craig Unger, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Craig Unger, who's the author of the New York Times bestseller House of Bush, House of Saud, the former deputy editor of the New York Observer and editor-in-chief of Boston Magazine. He's written about the Trump-Russia scandal for the New Republic and Vanity Fair, and his new book is House of Trump, House of Putin, The Untold Story of Donald Trump and the Russian Mafia. And he also has an article at the Washington Post, Trump's businesses are full of dirty Russian money. The scandal is that it's legal. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into democratic fratricide and digital technology's assault on humanity.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Yoshime, they don't believe me, but you won't let those robots defeat me. Those evil natured robots, they're programmed to destroy.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now in the studio is Douglas Rushkoff, named one of the world's 10 most influential intellectuals by MIT. He's an award-winning author, broadcaster, and documentarian who studies human autonomy in the digital age, the host of the popular Team Human podcast. He has written 20 books, including the bestsellers Present Shock and Program, or Be Programmed, written regular columns for Medium, CNN, Daily Beast, and The Guardian, and has made the PBS Frontline documentaries Generation Like and Merchants of Cool. And he's a research fellow at the Institute for the Future and the founder of the Laboratory for Digital Humanism at the City University of New York in Queens. And he's a professor of media theory and digital economics. And his latest book is Team Human. And he has an article at Medium, Time for Progressives to Stop Shaming One Another. Welcome to Background Briefing, Douglas Rushkoff.
I'm honored to be here.
Well, thanks. It's great to have you in studio. And I want to talk to you about progressives needing to stop shaming one another. Just a few days ago, Bernie Sanders complained about Think Progress, the Center for American Progress, attacking him. And they are, of course, pretty much Hillary people. And the last thing that the Democrats need is to reopen those wounds from the 2016 Democratic campaign between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. But that's something we can talk about. But just to touch on your book, Team Human, I wanted to start out talking about the 737 MAX crashes and what we're learning about it. In fact, I had an expert on aviation some time back who told the whole story well before the New York Times did their recent expose on. And obviously you have the corruption of the Trump era, the fact that there's no oversight, that the FAA basically let Boeing police themselves. So that's a product of of regulatory capture, which has happened under Trump. But the idea that they built this plane designed in 1967, and just rather than go back to scratch and build another one, they just sort of did this Rube Goldberg thing where they stretched it out to put more people in. And because the engines needed to be bigger, they had to move them further out of the wings and higher up, so they jutted forward more. And the thing was completely unflyable. And the only way you could fly it is through a computer. And then they put complicated software in the computer. And if you were an Ethiopian or an Indonesian airline and you couldn't afford the top software package, you just sort of ended up having to improvise, and thus two planes crashed. And frankly, the plane is not flyable. It really is. I mean, you take your life in your own hands if you ever get in that thing. And this represents a huge blow to brand America. Boeing is probably the most successful American brand around the world. So isn't this extraordinary? You have two issues. The book Team Human, the idea of the machine taking over from the human, is in this story. But the other story, of course, is the short-term greed of American capitalism under this criminal regime that we have. The blowback from that is the destruction of brand America.
Right. I mean, in some ways, it's just a continuation of this really anti-human agenda that's embedded in both capitalism and technological development. And so if you go even all the way back to the invention of the assembly line and the factory in the late Middle Ages, you know, we get taught in school that it was so that, oh, so you could make more widgets faster, that industrialism is faster and better. And it's like, no, it's not. All that really is the process of removing expertise from manufacturing so that you could pay the worker less. You know, once kings chartered a single company to be in charge of a particular industry, then everyone else who worked in that industry had to become employees for that one company. So if there were 100 shoe companies or jam companies, now the shoemakers and jam makers become employees of His Majesty's Royal Jam Company. But what is the employer really think at that point? Do they want the most skilled, expensive jam makers and shoemakers? No, they want to go to the medieval equivalent of the Home Depot parking lot, find an undocumented alien, train them in 15 minutes to do one teeny thing. So the development of technology and business has usually been about de-skilling the employee, just like in a grocery store, you get chopped vegetables, which de-skill the consumer, but you pay in money instead of labor.
And now you can check out through a machine that doesn't require a human, which, of course, saves them. So I always go through the line that has a human because I figure at least somebody's getting a paycheck.
Right. And the irony is they're not actually less expensive if you look at the entire ecosystem of costs. They're less expensive for that one manufacturer, and they externalize the cost to others. The same way when a company fires its receptionist and brings in a computer receptionist. It's cheaper for that company, but everybody who calls the company now has to spend an extra 20 minutes pushing buttons and waiting for other cues. So what's happened is you've made the process more expensive. So now with these airplanes, they're not actually less expensive in the long run in terms of human life, and but they require less skilled pilots, which is a trend that the airlines would love to bring in. And I guess people, human passengers who care less about the sanctity of their own lives. So we're building technology in companies really with utter disregard for human labor, human dignity, everything.
Right. And it was always thought that one of the sort of zenith of professionalism is an airline pilot with all of those lives in his hands, you know, and they no longer require that. They just want some, you know, kid that plays computer games and knows how to press buttons.
Right, because if one of your employees or some layer of your employees actually have necessary skills, then they've got leverage over you. If you have airplane pilots and they're looked up to as these people – you know, like almost Buckminster Fuller, like masters of the universe who understand physics and safety and technology, then they can unionize and demand six-figure salaries from you.
And again, I'm joined in the studio by Douglas Rushkoff, named one of the world's 10 most influential intellectuals by MIT. He's an award-winning author, broadcaster, and documentarian who studies human autonomy in the digital age. And he's a research fellow at the Institute for the Future, a founder of the Laboratory for Digital Humanism at City University of New York, professor of media theory and digital economics, also at the City University. And his latest book is Team Human. And he has an article at Medium, Time for Progressives to Stop Shaming One Another. Let's turn to that issue. And already we have a crowded field of Democrats, and some of them, because the field is so crowded, I think aren't running, like Sherrod Brown in Ohio, for example. So I'm not sure that already out of the gate the crowded field is not having a negative impact. And some of the candidates are just running on a single issue. There was a piece recently in the New York Times that suggested that it's a no-lose situation to be a candidate.
Yeah. Right. Why not? You'll get some publicity, you get your issue out there.
Right. And you recall the Kavanaugh hearing, many of them were auditioning and subsequently.
Right.
They're
and you're right, though. There's no lose for the individual candidate, but there is a loss to the field.
So you have the illusion of choice, but you actually have a cluster, and we'll bleep the rest of it out.
But the way that the candidates distinguish themselves from each other then ends up sometimes being really damaging to the whole, to the organism of the left or the progressives. So the thing that had gotten me upset was when I saw and I've always been upset by this one, but Bernie Sanders was being critiqued for using the word niggardly in 1986. And I was actually talking about it, and one of my students said, you can't even say that. You can't even – how could you say it? And I was explaining that niggardly, which means stingy was on my SATs, my Scholastic Aptitude Test in 1979. We had to learn the word. And Bernie Sanders used it in 1986, which I'm sorry to say is 33 years ago at this point. I mean, oh my gosh. But he used it in 1986, and there's a video of it. And now he's being criticized, you know, by the social justice warriors.
Racial insensitivity, right.
Right. And for having said that, doesn't that show that he's just an old white male and part of the problem? And the problem with this is not just what it does right now to our field, and that we're taking the guy who really pushed the Democratic Party to the left and now calling him out as some sort of racist for using this word in an almost Trump-like silliness. But even if they're right, and even if we should no longer use the word niggardly today because it sounds to people like you know, the same way we shouldn't use, you know, Burger King Whopper because it has, you know, a potential racial slur in there, we can start to be sensitive. But what it's doing is actually preventing us from making change, because if I know that every change we make, positive, progressive change to our behavior, now makes me liable for what I might have done 40 or 50 years ago, then I'm going to actually try to slow progress, because the more we progress, the more chance there is of me getting in trouble for having lived a long time, you know?
Right.
And that's a really dangerous place for us to go. And so what I'm asking is that what if we moved more towards truth and reconciliation rather than shaming?
Well, ironically, of course, it's the Center for American Progress. You use the word progress that Bernie Sanders is complaining about, that they're the kind of the Hillary squad are taking swipes at him. I don't know how much opposition research is already emerging in this crowded field. And obviously, because it's a crowded field, they're jugging to get attention.
Mm.
One of the most mystifying things is why that woman Lucy Flores, the legislator from Nevada, basically suggested that Vice President Biden had inappropriately I mean, it's not that she was lying, but she said, you know, he kissed me on the top of the head. It wasn't sexual and it wasn't a big deal. So the question then arises, well, why the hell did you go public? Because he's being you know, suggested and Franken got nailed.
Yeah. And the other thing I think about Biden, too, and again, maybe this just betrays that I'm an old person, but I remember when folks like Biden were considered And by say folks like Biden, I mean men who got a little touchy-feely and sentimental and would touch a woman on the shoulder, kiss them on the back of the head and say, oh, good luck. That was part of that was a progressive agenda too at the time. That was, if you remember, the era of Phil Donahue and Alan Alda and Real Men Can Eat Quiche. That, you know, Biden is not part of that tough guy John Wayne world, right, where you don't. And so in some ways, him being appropriately progressive to that moment, you know, the university presidents who hug the professors, and you remember that's looked at as somehow manhandling. But at the moment, it was actually seen as a kind of a softer male.
Right. Well, it raises the question of whether or not, I mean, I mentioned opposition research, whether there's some mendacity in all of this.
There is. And it's a bias. And yes. I met with Center for American Progress, from the head of the whole thing, right after Trump was elected, saying, now will you look at my I was doing memetics research at the time and I sort of figured out a lot of stuff about the landscape and about Hillary and said, now we need to do we need to promote progressive values in red states. We need to promote mutual aid, alternative currencies, favor banks, and get people in red states doing progressive things without even realizing it's progressive, so that by the time 4 years comes around, they will identify the behaviors and social mechanisms that they're a part of as part of this agenda they want to vote for. And the woman from CAP was like, no, we just do opposition research on Trump. We need to get people to hate Trump. Like, people already hate Trump enough. If this is all we have as a progressive, right, this is where we want to spend our time and technology is opposition research, then we really will become the party of negativity.
But haven't they learned from what happened with Hillary Clinton? That was her campaign. Trump is terrible. Deplorable. Remember the basket full of deplorable? Look where that got them.
Right. And what they don't realize is that they're falling into the same – this is what my whole book is about – this anti-human tactic. So that if we can't see the person under the MAGA hat as a human being, then how do we expect the MAGA hat person to see a Mexican as a human being? You know, we've got to look at them as – people, as real thinking people. So once you understand their logic, I've been living on this land for, you know, all 50 years I've been alive. My dad dug coal here, his father dug coal here, and now you want me to stop extracting value from the land that I'm standing on and learn how to make a solar panel for some company in China. There's logic there. We have to address their sense of disconnection from creation of value. I mean, all these folks are really making an almost Marxist argument, but they don't realize it.
Well, I found that a few days ago, last Sunday, when Mayor Pete Buttigieg made his announcement, the way that he dismissed Trump, he didn't go after Trump like Hillary did and saying he's evil and I'm good. He just basically dismissed it as a train wreck in Washington, and we're going to change the channel. And I think that is a much more intelligent approach.
Absolutely. Because otherwise all you're doing is talking about the thing. You're getting stuck on the flypaper at that point. And by doing that, he really does expose, oh, wait a minute, right, this is just a game show host with fascist ideology who ended up in this – how can you engage with that logically? It would be – you can't. So you do just have to move on and say, okay, so how are we going to move on from this?
Right.
And he does engage a little bit with Pence.
Oh, yeah. Well,
because at least Pence is kind of a traditional – in a way, a traditional arch-conservative.
Right. Well, but he's also provoking a debate, challenging the fact that the right in this country have confiscated the Bible as their own when the actual document in the Bible – doesn't support any of their positions.
Right.
And I think, you know, the religious left needs to be revived, and he may well be the vector.
Right. I mean, progressives, though, they also have to learn to contend with the sort of the binary quality of the digital age. You know, people do not understand national borders, immigration, who is us, who is them, what is rich, what is poor, and we don't yet have a way of discussing these issues that makes sense to people today.
So let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment, resuming the conversation with Douglas Rushkoff. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And again, we're joined in the studio by Douglas Rushkoff, named one of the world's 10 most influential intellectuals by MIT, an award-winning author, broadcaster, and documentarian who studies human autonomy in the digital age. He is a research fellow at the Institute for the Future and founder of the Laboratory for Digital Humanism at City University of New York, where he's a professor of media theory and digital economics. And his latest book is Team Human, and he has an article at Medium, Time for Progressives to Stop Shaming One Another. So you mentioned immigration, and there again, Trump is doing what he's doing because he thinks it's a winning argument, and he's certainly got his base riled up. I hope it's not true. I hope he's got a very narrow path, obviously, and I don't think it's enough of his people. But unless the Democrats can come up with a counter-narrative and recognize the depth of why in this country people are concerned, you can't. I mean, the example would of blindness on the Democratic side would be Beto O'Rourke's statement that we don't need a border at all, which is a wonderful concept. But you try and sell that in the heartland of America.
Right. And certainly not right now. I mean, it is true from a bigger picture perspective, the idea of the nation state, you know, at least this sort of Treaty of Versailles, whatever nation state that we're living with today, it was born in that same late medieval moment that we birthed corporate capitalism, you know, where we transitioned from the city state, which were these sort of vibrant market states that developed by real people. A city is kind of like a termite mound of human beings, that those were repressed in order to make room for the nation state, which gave power to a king. And they were these artificial boundaries around regions. They came up with myths of origin for nation states so that all these people living in different cities could now all be, you're all Italians, you're all French, you're all this. And none of those are real. Those are myths. Those are myths of even shared ethnic origin. So now that we're in the digital age, now that those boundaries are being broken, now that we're starting to see that these national boundaries are utterly artificial and we're retrieving the city-state again, that the cities are the places where we actually get climate change legislation happening. The cities are where we start to see functioning government again. It's confusing people. This is why we got Brexit in Great Britain. Like, wait a minute. We're not just part of this European Union thing. Isn't there something real? Hail Britannia. Aren't we a real country, goddammit? And in America, it's the same thing. It's the notion of a nation state has become so abstracted and so obsolete that the only way we can enforce what we think of as a national boundary is to put a literal wall there. You know, that's not just to keep these people out. It's to make sure we've got draw lines around this map. And that's a tough transition for people. And the left is not rising to the call of dealing with that sense of loss and fear that comes along with losing your nation.
Well, we did an interview the other day with the author of a new book about how the country always, the United States always operated on the idea of the frontier, that it was ever expanding, and it was, at its core, it was about optimism and future. And now there's being a retreat, and we're turning inward and building walls.
Yeah, and the other problem with that forwardness, though, is we've gone forward, 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 and Silicon Valley is still the place that's trying to go forward, and they're still colonizing, only they're not colonizing more territory. They're colonizing human consciousness. They're colonizing us. Right. You know, and that's what people start to feel. It's their attention that's being colonized. It's their cognition.
Right. Well, I heard a most alarming thing from somebody that I respect, probably one of the most famous sociologists on the planet. And he was telling me he's been very concerned about Stephen Bannon's activities attacking the Pope. And CNN last Sunday had a special on it. And looking into we know the motives are largely about white nationalism. And, of course, the Bannon and all these right-wing, ultra-right, Opus Dei kind of Catholics are saying they're attacking the Pope because of the church hasn't dealt with the sex abuse scandal, which is total lie. They're just using that.
Yeah.
Their real issues with the Pope are ideological, that he's too much of a humanist.
Like the Catholic Church always has, the Pope is retrieving the medieval sensibilities that I'm talking about.
Right.
The commons, subsidiarity, distributism, the economic models where workers own the means of production. I mean, that's the popes were the ones who were the most progressive. The popes are the ones who were brought down by corporate capitalism in the 13th century.
So the question arises, we know what the strategy for Bannon and these right-wings are. They want to get enough right-wing governments in Europe elected to get to the one-third threshold in the European Parliament so that Le Pen in France and Orban in Hungary and all these horrible right-wingers and AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland in Germany, if they get to the one-third threshold in the European Parliament, they can essentially paralyze the European Parliament. And that would, of course, serve Putin's interests because he wants the Western Europe to be weakened. And he's, that's why he supported Brexit. So we know what the motives are. But who is financing Bannon? They've got a big monastery now that the headquarters just outside of Rome. And that's when the suggestion was that some of these big Silicon Valley tech companies are quietly financing him because they have a different agenda. They want to weaken the European Parliament because they're the only people that are passing legislation to curtail the monopoly power of Google and Facebook. So that is something. I don't have the resources to look into it, but I hope somebody like the New York Times and others do look into that.
Or at least, ProPublica,
seems to look
at these.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I would think they're partly being funded by that, if at least indirectly, because Europe is the only one who's resisting, privacy standards or lack of privacy standards. And I mean, even though the ways they have been pretty ineffectual, I mean, right now it feels as if regulation's gotten to is the place where, okay, if you want to see this website, click on this thing. Click on this that says that we're going to look at all your stuff. And if you don't click on it, then, you can't read our periodical. Go away.
Right.
If that's the extent of privacy regulation or your right to ownership of one's own images, then it's pretty toothless. But, no, I could see that. There's plenty of folks who would want to fund deregulation of Europe.
Right. So what's going to stop this trajectory? Because, 10 years ago, ExxonMobil was the most powerful corporation on the planet. Now it's Alphabet, Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Apple, and Amazon. And they are growing so fast and they're getting so powerful. So in 10 years' time, they were literally, Gestern Deutschland, heute Europa, morgen die Welt. That was Hitler's, they'll literally take over the world. So what is stopping them? The number one visitor to the Obama White House was Schmidt from Google. And, I'm sure they're still spending money on Capitol Hill like crazy. So do you have a sense, since you recognize the danger of surveillance capitalism, do you have any sense that it's going to be addressed in any realistic way? I mean, everything that Zuckerberg says is ludicrous. He talks out of both sides of his mouth, makes false promises and denies the reality of what he's doing.
I mean, the one interesting thing about these folks is that, I mean, other than maybe Peter Thiel at Palantir, is I think the chieftains of the digital economy mostly want to think of themselves as good people.
You know, let's not do evil, right?
Right. They're doing evil because they're not educated, you know, or because they went to B.J. Fogg's class in captology at Stanford, or René Giraud or somebody. They didn't actually take ethics and sociology. But when I hear or speak to folks like a Bezos or Zuckerberg, they're not like a Donald Trump or something. They're not, you know, just rapacious venture capitalists. They simply are unaware of the economic operating system that they're riding on top of. They think they're creating technologies to solve problems rather than creating technologies to solve capitalist problems. I want to re-socialize America and make $100 trillion. You know, you can't kind of do both of those things at the same time. But they're slowly realizing that. When I go to Uber, say, and do a talk, I'm both dismayed and heartened by the fact that they're talking about universal basic income. So on the one hand, universal basic income will help them continue to pay unlivable wages to their drivers. But they're at least thinking that, someone's going to have to give people money so they can live. So they're at least looking that the model doesn't quite work. I mean, I think our best defense is localism, is the more you know people around you, the more resilient you are to these technologies, to these platforms. The more friends you have in real life, the more you're willing to do and receive favors from people in your neighborhood, the closer you are to where your food is sourced from, the more resilient your community would be. I mean, I would love to return to this notion that these technologies are mainly for entertainment and knowledge, not for facilitating your actual survival. You know, and survival is not that tricky. You know, if we start looking at what do we actually need? We need, you know, basic energy to grow food and educate our children and shelter ourselves. You know, this is not rocket science.
So would this then be just to touch on a kind of utopian vision and, you know, what seems to be a dystopian trajectory on, because, you know, Oxfam said that about 85 families that control the world, and that's pretty close to what I understand to be the case. So the world is inexorably moving towards a kind of new form of medievalism. You were talking about it earlier. But if you go back to the Middle Ages, the idea that you just have a small aristocracy that own everything, then you have a very thin sliver managerial class, wealth managers, accountants and lawyers, and then you have this vast, roiling global peasantry. So that seems to be where we're heading. But if there's a universal income, then people could probably discover their own talents. You could create a kind of artisanal. Is that a possibility? That, in other words, if robots are doing all of the manufacturing and people have nothing to do, why not make creative use of that time and start to rediscover a kind of artisanal economy?
Yes and no. I mean, yes, I could see if were true. In other words, if robots were really making stuff and more efficiently than humans, without the need for slavery to get the rare earth metals to make the robots, without the need for massive externalization of pollution and poverty elsewhere. If all that were true, then sure, have as a temporary transition, have 5-10 years where you're giving universal basic income to all sorts of citizens so they can innovate and figure out other things and make it to this next place. If you think of UBI or universal basic income as a permanent strategy, then all you're really doing is printing money to give to consumers for them to spend at the same places. So then Uber and Amazon and Travis Kalanick and Jeff Bezos are just getting more and more of the assets. And we're moving towards that bad period of feudal medievalism. What I'm looking to go to would be the very late medieval period, after the Crusades, when the markets opened up in every city and people were trading back and forth. They had local currencies that were issued in the morning and would expire by the end of the day. And we saw a huge rise in real distributed wealth, where people were working an average of 3 days a week in late medieval times, where women were taller than at any time until the 1980s in England. So it was actually, I mean, not that it was perfect, but it was the beginning of a circulatory kind of people-driven bottom-up economy that was arrested by law, by regulation, by central currency, by chartered monopolies. And yeah, we're going to go back to one or the other medieval period now. And that's why I'm looking not at universal basic income, but universal basic assets. Who actually owns the means of production? I'm more interested in platform cooperatives and worker-owned businesses. I'm very inspired by, you know, boomers who are retiring and then instead of giving their business to their kids, are giving the businesses to the workers. And we're seeing it, you know, through ESOPs, through employee stock ownership plans and co-op conversion. And those companies, once the workers and the communities have a stake in the companies that are operating there, then you're not going to start polluting into your local river. You're not going to have Flint, Michigan problems because you live in the place where your company operates. So you want it to operate in a way that's not externalizing all these costs.
Well, that sounds like a perfect solution. So where is the manifesto? Have you written it?
Well, Team Human is a manifesto. You can also read Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus. Looks at how do we transition from this digital industrialism that we're in to something I'm calling digital distributism. You could read Trevor Schultz's work in the platform cooperative movement, of which I'm a part. Go to a platform.coop, and you'll see a whole bunch of stuff on how we can retake ownership. Look at Astra Taylor's work and the debt rolling debt jubilee on how we get off debt. So there are plenty of ways to move this forward. It just really requires a little bit of, I hate to say it, a little bit of faith in human beings' ability to actually create value in an ongoing way for one another.
Well, Douglas Rushkoff, I thank you so much for joining us today in the studio.
Thank you. Thanks for what you do.
And again, I've been speaking with Douglas Rushkoff, who was named one of the world's 10 most influential intellectuals by MIT. He's an award-winning author, broadcaster, and documentarian who studies human autonomy in the digital age and the host of the popular Team Human podcast. He has written 20 books, including the bestsellers Present Shock and Program or Be Programmed. And he's written regular columns for Medium, CNN, Daily Beast, and The Guardian, and has made the PBS Frontline documentaries Generation Like and Merchants of Cool. And he's a research fellow at the Institute for the Future and founder of the Laboratory for Digital Humanism at City University of New York, where he's also a professor of media theory and digital economics. And his latest book is Team Human. And he has an article at Medium, Time for Progressives to Stop Shaming One Another. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.